This is Limit Up, the place where we explore markets, strategies, and trading psychology to take your trading to the next level.
Hello, traders, and welcome to this very special 2020 edition of the Limit Up podcast presented by Top Step Trader. I'm Jack Pelzer. Happy New Year and Happy New Decade. It's actually New Year's Eve as I'm recording this, but I'm just going to go ahead and assume the world didn't come to an end in the next 12 hours. So, yeah, we continue to be on holiday hiatus over here at Top Step HQ, which means I am still recording this introduction from my wife's closet. But that doesn't mean we don't have an exciting, brand new episode for you all today. Jeff will be sitting down with John Nyhoff in the studio, not in my wife's closet. John is an assistant professor of finance at Lewis University and a principal focusing on derivatives education and consulting at John Nyhoff Consulting. He's also written three books on finance and trading, including the CME's Risk Management Handbook. So retail traders, this interview is definitely right up your alley. Hopefully, you'll be able to use some of John's advice in the new year. But before we get started, I just wanted to remind everyone out there that we are still gathering responses for our 2020 listener survey. Just go ahead and take that at topsteptrader.com/listener survey. That's topsteptrader.com/listener survey. There you can take the short multiple choice questionnaire, and you will be rewarded with both an improved Limit Up podcast in 2020 and also perhaps a $100 Amazon gift card, because we'll be drawing 10 lucky winners from the people that take the survey. So be sure to go do that. So in the meantime, please enjoy today's interview between Jeff Carter and John Nyhoff. I'll see you at the end with a little more housekeeping.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Limit Up podcast on Top Step Trader. My name is Jeff Carter. You can find me online at pointsandfigures.com or on Twitter at pointsandfigures. Just a side note, I'm raising money for the National World War II Museum at gofundme.com to name a room after the unknown soldier at their new hotel, the Higgins Hotel. And if you could support that and share it with your friends, that would be great. We welcome to the program today John Nyhoff. He was on the trading floor running a desk for Mitsubishi for years. He was upstairs and he has 30 years of experience in futures, and he now is a professor of finance at Lewis University. Welcome to the program, John.
Hey, good morning, Jeff.
It's great to reconnect with you. We knew each other while we were on the floor. What was your badge?
I was NEJ. You know, I did something real creative. My initials backwards.
Yeah.
Found out in Swedish it meant no. So, I mean...
So nothing on the OM exchange.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were different than me. So I was a pit trader, local, trading my own money. You ran a desk. So can you tell people kind of what your job was day to day?
Well, day to day job was to make contact with our institutional customers. Being one of the larger banks in the world, we had our bank, obviously, as one of our predominant customers, but we also had a variety of affiliates of the bank and a variety of other institutional entities, predominantly of a Japanese flavor, but also European flavor from the insurance industry, some pension funds. And our job was to communicate market information to these people, make trade recommendations, hopefully encourage them to trade with us and, survive from day to day.
I see. And what were their goals? Like, how did you cultivate those customers? And then what were they trying to accomplish?
Well, the bank customers, it was kind of interesting. I mean, you thought we were working with two principal groups, both a speculative group and a hedge group. It seemed that the hedge group may have actually done more speculation than the traditional speculation group. So our main purpose was to provide them with trading ideas to generate profits. I think, you know, the same thing on the other institutional customer base. We were looking to provide them perhaps with some basic hedge strategies, again, market flavor about where we thought the dollar market was, because we principally concentrated on euro dollars and treasury futures. So they were looking for points of entry and points of exit.
And with different locals on the floor, or even people that are trading on Top Step Trader, they're kind of, they'll chart, they'll pick a point. And, you know, even when I was on the floor, there were not a lot of people that had overnight positions. There were some. What was the time horizon for these institutional traders in general when they put a trade on?
It could have been anywhere from several days to multiple months. I mean, not to be a little facetious here, but sometimes it all depends on how well the trade worked out. Given the capital base of some institutions, I think they exhibited some of the tendencies that you see of a lot of novice traders. That is, they got into a position, it turned bad, and then they turned to the prayer rug approach, hoping it would come back. And sometimes they would get married to a position because they didn't want to realize the loss. And I can think of several occasions where there were some huge mark-to-market losses, and because of the capability to sustain a position over time, it eventually came back and worked wonderfully. But I'm thinking that's not an approach that most traders should try and attempt.
Hope is not a trade. So when they got married to trades and you thought they should take a loss, what were the conversations with them like? Like, how did you talk to them, and how did you sort of work with them?
Most of the time, these conversations would be taking place with head traders, and they were somewhat adamant sometimes. They just didn't want to hear about the bad trades. We knew they had them. They know they had them. And they were just saying that sometimes they would actually, you know, scale in on as it was moving against them and add to positions because they were convinced. But again, I think that's a function of how much capital do you have to trade with? And again, with larger institutions, sometimes they, you know, they don't want, you know, again, you have to remember we were dealing with a Japanese populace. So there was a face saving mode. And I think it was rather remarkable that sometimes these positions were developed as a consensus within the institution. So it wasn't just, say, the head trader admitting they were wrong. It would be, you know, their senior management perhaps admitting they were wrong, and they just were not want to do that.
Yeah, interesting. So there was always this notion in the pit that around this time of year, bonuses would be hit. You know, if some trader at some desk did really well, they'd get a bonus from their hedge fund or their institution. And so they would slow down their trading. Was that true or not?
Not for the institutions that we dealt with, because I don't think their compensation levels were, or their total compensation packages were tied that significantly to trading performance.
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of these folks we dealt with were on a particular career path that they were hoping to graduate senior management, which meant more of an oversight as opposed to a trading responsibility. So if there was opportunities, they were there. It didn't matter whether, you know, you hit Thanksgiving or you were halfway through December. If the market developed in such a manner that they could profit from it, hey, they were willing to jump in with both feet.
Right. Interesting. That's cool. So what, you know, reflecting back on your 30 years there, what was like one of the most amazing things you saw and maybe one of the scariest things you saw?
You know, I think going back to the early days, if we went back to when euro dollars really started to take off in the late 80s and we were still on the lower trading floor, to see how people would literally fall out of the pit during a period of heightened market activity. And you thought you were, you know, dealing with somebody that you could flash an order into, and next thing you know, they're almost laying on the ground. Because, I mean, there was competition for space. And we were, before we moved to the upper trading floor, we were tremendously space constrained. I think you can recollect probably what that environment was like. And it was just, I don't know, for lack of a better way to describe it, it was, we actually get business done in this particular fashion. And we were more of the trading type often, where we would not be continual traders and we'd come in and execute for size intermittently, and all of a sudden they have a big order and you're looking in the pit and, you know, the clerks or the broker you were trying to communicate with, you know, were, let's be kind, you know, significantly disrupted. It was It's kind of different than the current method of trading.
Yeah, how about it? What was the scariest thing you ever saw on the floor?
I think the scariest things when you knew you executed a trade incorrectly. I mean, you know, as careful as you were and as many checks and balances there were, if all of a sudden you were dealing with, say, a multiple thousand lot order and you realize, oh my God, I did this wrong. And then you're trying to rapidly rectify it and, you know, not lose too much money in the process. That's probably from a desk perspective, that's probably the scariest thing. And I think most important, the first time it happens and you think, oh my God, I'm getting fired as soon as this happened. And to realize that, you know, we had tremendous management, and, you know, it's like, hey, stuff happens. Fortunately, it wasn't, you know, the loss was considerable from anybody's perspective, but it wasn't enough to, you know, have to shut the doors.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. I have a side story on that. It's like today, if you were doing that on a computer, even you could triple check it and still have a fat finger, right?
Sure.
And be left with the same problem. And when I was a clerk in the Eurodollar options, this is back in 1986, okay? So the Eurodollar options are trading like, a big day was 15,000 options. And this guy had come over from the Board of Trade to the Merck. And instead of using Merck hand signals, he used Board of Trade hand signals.
Oh, that could be dangerous.
And he says, like, you know, 42 puts or calls or something. I can't remember the exact strike. What's here? And I gave him one bit of two. And he said, I'll never forget this. He said, pay two on 2,000, which I leaned to my broker and I said, hey, pay two on 2,000. And the broker looked at me and he didn't say check it. He just executed. And everybody's trying to sell premium. So they're like, sold, sold, sold. And then, of course, they're hedging them in the futures. And there's all this noise. And I go, two on 2,000, you're filled. And the blood drained out of this guy's face. And he's like, two on 200. I go, no, that's 1,000 here, buddy. And he's like, oh. So we had to scramble to get out of them.
Yeah, I can fathom. I was in similar circumstances on more than one occasion where something to that effect transpired.
Yeah.
So that's awfully scary.
And so your partner on the desk was the chairman for a while of the Mercantile Exchange, Scott Gordon.
Well, that's kind of kind to say Scott Gordon was my partner.
But, yeah.
Well, I mean, my colleague on the desk.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, Scott and I, we worked together probably for the better part of 16, 17 years.
Yeah. What was that like to have a guy that was kind of in Merck politics working with you on the desk?
Well, I mean, he was always in Merck politics. He probably was at the desk during, you know, morning hours, better part of half the day. And then when typically after London closed, things would slow down and then, you know, effectively, you could say Scott was really in charge during the early days. And then when he left, I would take over that responsibility. So it was, it was a great relationship. He was, how should we put this kindly? He was a much more seasoned individual in the realm of the futures industry because he started, at least on the floor, he had about 10 years worth of experience before I ever moved down to the floor. I already had multiple years, but most of my experience was either upstairs doing research or upstairs doing institutional brokering. So he really was ungodly in terms of help, in terms of making my transition from an upstairs environment to a floor-based environment.
Interesting. And he runs Rosenthal now, I think.
Well, he just recently retired.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I actually had lunch with Scott, I think, all of 2 days ago.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's great. And so you transitioned off the floor. What are you doing now?
Well, now I'm a university professor. So after spending, I think it was approximately 31 years, either upstairs or downstairs in different capacities in the futures industry, I kind of was encouraged to seek other opportunities a number of years ago during one of the downsizings at CME Group. And I'd always taught classes on the side. I think for about 15 years, I taught the intro or intermediate options class when the CME used to have their education institute. And I've taught a number of classes, either at DePaul or IIP, and basically derivatives classes that included futures options and swap theory and trading strategies. So, and I think, you get to at some point in your life, you want to have a little bit more free time and being a full-time. It's like I used to tell some of my friends who are in academia, it's not like you guys have a real job. So I
thought, yeah.
I mean, I think, in my capacity at Mitsubishi, a lot of times, on a short week, we'd be working 50 hours, sometimes 55, 60 hours and taking phone calls in the middle of the night. So this idea of teaching three or four classes a semester and, it's like I was talking to somebody the other day. I only get 4 weeks off for Christmas this year. And then, I got to wait a month and a half to have spring break and then another 8 weeks to have 3.5 months off in the summer. It's a tremendously difficult transition. I mean, it's nice to have something that keeps your mind busy, that you work with some interesting younger folks, but you have a remarkable amount of free time, and you can set your schedule. If you need to read something, if you feel like reading at 10 o'clock at night, hey, you put your time in as opposed to, hey, I've got to be in an office from 8 to 5 or 6.
Right. So your students entered the CME Trading Challenge. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the CME Trading Challenge, I think, is a tremendous opportunity for people who want to get their feet wet in a professional paper trading environment.
Yeah.
CME works with CQG, I think, in this particular go-round, and they provide, technical analysis, analytics, provide real-time data feeds, basically treat the folks, the students that participate, just like they're, professional traders. They put some risk limits in for them and give them $1 million account and say, hey, go to it for the next month and let's see how you do. And I think, as I mentioned to you briefly before, I think I should have had these kids managing my money. But they made somewhere about 17 to 18% profit over the course of the month. But that said, they weren't good enough to place in the top three amongst the various student groups that participated.
Amazing.
So I thought the results were astounding myself.
And you have to be a student at a university that participates in this, correct?
Yeah, you have to be either an undergraduate or a graduate student. You need a professor to act as your moderator of sorts. But effectively, you give an account number to the students and they just are off on their own. If they want to seek advice, I think a couple times they asked about, some basic risk management strategies. Other than that, they were just gung-ho to trade, and they were trading some things I don't think I would ever get involved with. I think most of the profits came out of trading Bitcoin futures.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
So it's hey, good luck and God bless on that one. I was trying to tell them how to trade euro dollars and bonds, and that wasn't juicy enough for them.
The Bitcoin space is very, very interesting to me. I, as a venture capitalist, we're investors in openfinance.io, which trades securitized tokens. And then I invested in a company called cover.ai, which is insurance on the blockchain. And today I just bought this thing for just giggles. It's called Helium. I'm going to plug it in and see. We'll see what it's all about. But it's a very interesting space to me. Did these people trade futures and options or just futures or just options?
It was just futures. They didn't have the capacity during this simulated trading session to allow options trading for some reason, but they indicated they hope to evolve to allow that possibility during the next year or two. It was swinging, for the fences in whatever they thought the most volatile products that they could manage were.
So what classes are you teaching right now? I mean, just in general.
I think for some reason they thought I knew something about derivatives. So I teach a class every year in futures and options. But I also teach investment classes. On either side of my floor-based experience, I worked in the research department at CBOT or CME Group, and we were always investigating new products. So
right.
I work predominantly in both fixed income and equity market research. So picked up a few skills in that particular capacity. So I try and relay that to the students. And
what do you think the benefit to a trader understanding the academic principles behind all this stuff is? Because, for example, you know, back in the day when, you know, you're a local, a lot of us just showed up and, you know, you didn't have any background in economics or finance or anything like that. You just went into the pit and you started trading. I mean, take me for an example. I knew macro and micro econ. I had taken a principles of finance course at the University of Illinois, which gave me the principles of finance, but it certainly wasn't specialized into derivatives or anything like that. I mean, I did know what an interest rate was, but I certainly didn't know how to calculate it. And I just traded, you know. What advantage do you think traders today would have by having the academic knowledge?
Well, I think it depends on what your perspective is. I think you could probably bifurcate the traders in terms of people are in for, you know, extremely short-term durations, almost even if they're still point and click, quasi-algorithmic, and you have people who are position traders who are in for the longer term. I'm not sure that a lot of academic background helps anybody from the pure short-term trading standpoint. I think, you know, sometimes you need to develop a feel for the market. You obviously have to understand a little bit of the nuance of the particular contracts that you're trading. But, you know, delving deeply academically probably doesn't lend too much assistance. On the other hand, if you're going to be more of a position trader following trends, following macroeconomic trends, then it probably helps to have a little bit better, I guess, institutional knowledge, a little bit better technical knowledge about just, you know, major indicators, major trends, major government policies, how it relates domestically to internationally, because there's spillover effects from, you know, that's the thing I think I had the hardest time thinking about early days is I was, you know, U.S. dollar, U.S. market focused and came to realize, my God, Asia and Europe actually happen to be relatively important in this context. So understanding the interrelationships, from a risk management or portfolio management standpoint, if you're responsible for managing a great deal of money, then having a few more quantitative skills and understanding how to use technology to help manage your positions becomes important. So
yeah, that's for sure. Back when we were sort of in the Eurodollar pit, Japan was, you know, sort of that part of the world that they were the force. And of course, you know, London and the EU, and then the Iron Curtain falls and China rises. And China is such a force now. So understanding the relationships between everybody is key, I think, if you're going to position trade, you know, a contract like Eurodollars or U.S. Treasuries or something like that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you have to understand who's the major users of the markets. I mean, how much do they control? It helps to have a wide enough customer base to understand when somebody has an inkling that they want to make a substantive readjustment to a position. And you can almost kind of, you know, read the tea leaves about what might transpire as a consequence. And, you know, it's the funny thing about reading tea leaves, though. Sometimes you hit it right on the head, and other times you totally misinterpret. So
yeah, no kidding. Happened to me a lot. You know, the Eurodollar is going to go away, and it was introduced in '81 at the CME to represent the LIBOR rate, the London Interbank Rate, and that was heavily manipulated in the '08 crisis. A lot of guys I knew were still trading it, and they couldn't figure out why rates weren't going up at the time. What do you make of the end of LIBOR, and do you think CME is going to be able to make the switch to the new contract that they're listing, or do you think there's an opportunity for somebody like Richard Sandor to come through with his Ameribor contract and take market share?
You know, I mean, the thing is, you can never say never about what the transition is, but I think, you know, if you look at where the CME has a major toll hold, they are finally clearing a fair amount of over-the-counter interest rate swaps. I think to that extent, you know,
the typical language that's tossed out is they offer a lot of capital efficiency to major institutions in terms of pairing off the futures versus the OTC cleared product. It would seem to be that I'm not sure that Richard Sandor's outfit is going to be the main competitor. I'd be more concerned about ICE in terms of their clearing facility for swaps, and perhaps they can get a toehold and offer some capital efficiencies in that dimension if they pair up in that dimension. But I still think, you know, CME is the party to defeat.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt about it. I think when you're talking about capital efficiencies, you can trade the entire yield curve with the U.S. Treasury
yeah,
complex,
plus you can
and then cross margin
treasuries.
The,
and
right.
I don't
right.
think, you know, nobody's going to pull the treasury market away from CME Group.
No.
Yes, the all-in possibility of pairing things off and gaining capital efficiencies, that seems to be the method to the madness in terms of where you want to trade.
Right. Plus, you can cross margin into the equities and then all the other stuff, Forex.
Sure. And,
yeah. Just a teaser for people that are listening, Richard Sandor is going to be on this podcast soon.
I'm sure Richard would probably choose to differ with that assessment.
Yeah, I'm sure he will. But, you know, what's interesting is he created, you know, those interest rate contracts at the CBOT. You created and did research on contracts at both CBOT and the CME. What goes into making up a good contract?
I think at the end of the day, is there truly market demand? You know, the thing you have to overcome is everybody says they'll use a new contract.
Right. They do, don't they?
Yeah. But, I mean, but the problem is, you know, it's the old adage, if they build it, will they really come? I mean, that's the real difficulty. I think, you know, some of the more easily accomplished tasks, and this isn't in the early days, but in the more recent vintages, if you find a couple institutional participants who really have customer demand and they're willing to support the contract, that makes life incredibly easy. When you pull a rabbit out of the hat and you say, hey, this sounds like a great idea, and you go talk to people, but at the end of the day, if no one truly demonstrates that they have an absolute need for this, then you're kind of, you know, you're fishing in a pond where there just aren't really any fish.
Right, right. Yeah, I can remember contracts we launched at the Merck that seemed great on paper that just never went anywhere. Agency futures is one that I recall. The diff contracts seem to be a really cool contract that never went anywhere.
You know, we tried inflation futures and things of that nature. They just didn't come to pass. I mean, they're all, and one of the difficulties you find is a lot of contracts tend to be one-sided. It's easy to find the sellers in a certain environment. Nobody in their right mind wants to buy. So it takes two to tango, so that's sometimes a difficult matchmaking process.
You do have to have natural buyers and natural sellers, and then market makers that are willing to come in. Which, if there's natural buyers and natural sellers, will market makers flock to a contract, or what do they need to see, you think, to incent them to come into a contract to trade it?
Well, if you have natural buyers and sellers and there's order flow from the get-go, and market makers, you know, for the most part, will make markets in anything. And then obviously they adjust the spread until they think there's sufficient flow. But as long as you have some kind of flow, there's always seems to be some market-making entity that's adventurous enough to want to participate. But again, the difficulty you have is you launch a contract, there's almost no outside order flow coming in, and maybe you got one market maker trying to pick off another for a little while. That's not sustainable.
Right. No, not at all. And in some of the futures contracts today, with the consolidation of the industry, there's relatively few market makers making markets in some of these contracts.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you've seen that as, you know, I think you can draw analogies to a lot of different industries as industry mature or as industries mature and markets get a little bit more efficient. The strong survive, and people who were dependent upon relatively easy layups, they fall to the wayside. And so you get concentration. I think what you're seeing is you get a more concentrated market making environment, but that makes for an interesting competitive advantage because, again, if you went back to your and my early days in the industry, you know, used to cajole people to walk into a pit to make markets and just do things for a short bit of time. And I think you used to do the same thing in the early days of market making, you used to try and convince the market makers this was for the good of the industry. And then the exchanges went public and the market makers said, well, you know, you're in it to make a profit. We need to make money too. And the dynamic changes after a while.
Yeah, right. That's for sure. And, you know, you just saw today the news is that Schwab is buying TD Ameritrade in a, I don't know, is it a $40 billion or $25 billion? I didn't see the headline number, but, you know, consolidation is happening across the industry for a lot of reasons. Efficiency is one of them, but yeah, that was an interesting news that came out today.
Yeah. I think that was one of the reasons Schwab may have, you know, launched this idea of free trading is there. You know, they're more a bank than they are a broker at this particular point in time. So they're not that commission dependent, whereas I think TD is substantively more dependent than, you know, you just can't compete if you lose 30 or 40% of your revenue stream.
Yeah. What's interesting is creative destruction happens. So Robinhood came on the scene and offered zero commissions to people. And really is making a dent in the brokerage industry right now, which causes everybody to go to zero commissions to compete so that they keep customers. And then, of course, they sell their order flow and stuff and figure out ways to make it on the back end. But you really, to compete at scale, you need a lot of assets in the bank to offer sort of your top-line revenue driver at free.
That's it. I mean, you know, hopefully, I mean, I think, you know, you look at it from the standpoint, hey, you don't have to pay us if you're going to actually trade. But again, it's just like most brokers still put on their best salesmanship tools to try and convince you, you got to pay them management fees to manage your money better than what you could do yourself.
So Yeah. That's for sure. It's interesting. So what do you think, like, where do you see the future of the futures industry going? What, you know, if you had to make like two or three predictions of stuff that's going to happen that hasn't happened yet, what do you see happening?
You know, I think you prospectively, depending upon the regulatory environment, could see, I mean, even more consolidation than what you currently have. I mean, again, you just mentioned the old economies of scale argument. You know, one of the biggest and most expensive deliverables is the trading platform and, you know, increasing speed to the extent, you know, speed of transaction can be enhanced. So that may be one particular dimension that continues to take place in spite of how much it's taken place over the last 15 years. I think a couple other things is that you may see some of the lesser contracts no longer exist in a pure futures environment, and maybe you see a little bit more dominance in terms of the benchmark contracts as futures become more entrenched as a necessary risk transfer tool. You know, one of the things I think you've seen, and maybe this goes even further, is look at what's happened in the option space. You went from, I think when we started, where an option expired every 3 months, to introduce serials, and then you went to weeklies and month ends, and now you've got Monday and Wednesdays. So I think, you know, it's, to the extent bandwidth increases and market makers are willing, you're going to have daily expiries of these, not just in the dominant contracts, but or the high volume contracts, perhaps even in some of the lesser contracts. So to that extent, I think you may see options start to take on a little bit more market share relative to futures in an exchange traded capacity, simply because they may offer tremendously greater time-wise flexibility. So I think those are some of the most obvious things. That,
So one thing that crosses my mind as you talk about that is an institutional trader, an institutional player like a McDonald's or, you know, somebody like that understands risk. They can fundamentally calculate it for their business, but the average person on the street doesn't. And there is no, I mean, Tasty Trade's done it to a certain point, like trying to educate people about risk and how to manage it, but nobody's really turned the key there. And I don't know quite what that looks like. But I think, you know, when you talk about going from sort of quarterly expiration of options to almost daily, that's really allowing people to manage risk a lot more efficiently. You see anything like that on the horizon that gets commoditized down to sort of the average mom and pop business?
You know, it's certainly possible given some sort of technological improvement. But I think, you know, again, let's go back to the point that it takes two to tango. I'm not sure that for smaller business entities where, you know, you maybe have one principal or you've got a couple of partners and, you know, they're scratching to make out a living, that they really have enough time bandwidth to be that concerned about some of those dimensions. So I think there's, you can kind of reach down the ladder, so to speak, in terms of size of organizations where risk management tools appeal. But I still think, you know, if you look at most businesses, they're not that large. So they just don't have the personal capacity in order to accomplish something like that.
Yeah, I think like, so if I put on my 50-year in the future hat on, with the advent of quantum computing and artificial intelligence and things like that, there may be ways to program that where they don't even have to think about it. It's just a software thing that you buy monthly that artificially looks at your data from your business and then hedges it. And you don't even think about it.
The personal element comes into play, though, and I think this is always a sense of difficulty for a small organization, is when do you cede control over a certain element of your business to somebody else?
Yeah, that's true.
So that's, I mean, that perhaps, you know, again, based on, as you're talking about, some major technological changes and improvements that that may become commonplace. Again, you know, some of the things you take for granted now were not even thought of or considered to be totally incorrect 50 years ago. I mean, look at the difference between active investing and passive investing. So obviously philosophies change, and, you know, you didn't go to the political environments. Like, you know, you could say, how could this unknown ever get elected? Well, hey, you know, things happen, and sometimes they gain momentum, and something you couldn't fathom just occurs.
Right. The active versus passive thing, I think, is interesting because it's just about the math. I mean, if you look at returns over the long haul, Fama's sense of passive investing that he proposed in 1962, I believe, is finally playing out, and it's playing out in a big way. As a matter of fact, I was reading an article in Nevada. The guy that runs their pension funds has a very small office, like a school desk, you know, and he invests only passively. He will not do hedge funds. He doesn't do any private equity or venture capital. And his returns are beating everybody else's with lower costs.
Well, I think especially over the course, ever since in the post-financial crisis environment, if you look at the performance of hedge funds and what they're still demanding for compensation relative to their performance track. I mean, you know, I think, you know, you look at one of the local outfits, Citadel, still seems to be doing pretty well, but the rest of their peers don't seem to be able to truly justify the cost of participating with them. So.
Right. No, I agree. And the interesting thing, you know, is you got to know where your edge is. If your edge is only speed, then that's not a true edge. And I think, you know, in Citadel's case, they've got, you know, invested, you know, billions in technology and speed, but they also invested billions in human capital inside the organization so that they feel like they have the best sort of intelligence to create an edge for themselves. And that maybe is a reason to take a class from you.
Yeah, tell them to come on down. Unfortunately, Romeoville's not particularly in the greatest location for the Citadel individuals, but it'd be interesting because I think, you know, one of the things you always learn is that when you get into an educational environment, hopefully there's a two-way flow of information, and it's always great to have an industry practitioner in the audience because as much as you think you might know, it's remarkable how much. Your students can teach you at times.
Well, thank you very much, John, for coming on the program. I really appreciate your time today. And you can find him at Lewis University online on LinkedIn and on their website. And I hope you have a great trading day. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jeff, great talking to you.
Traders, thank you for making it to the end of yet another episode of the Limit Up Podcast presented by Top Step Trader. We hope your 2020 is already off to an incredible start. Next week, we'll be back in the office. All right. And we'll use that opportunity to announce some of the winners of our listener survey. We'll see who got those $100 gift cards. So be sure to tune in for that. We'll also be sure to see you then. In the meantime, namaste and trade well.
This episode produced by Dante32. Futures and Forex trading contains substantial risk and is not for every investor. An investor could potentially lose all or more than their initial investment. Risk capital is money that can be lost without jeopardizing one's financial security or lifestyle. Only risk capital should be used for trading, and only those with sufficient risk capital should consider trading. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future results.